maybe a bit over half a kilometer, and the climb less than 50 meters, I estimated. The terrain was rough. The canyon here narrowed with a stream cascading down rapidly over rocks. We had to walk part of the way in the stream bed, stumbling over wet, slick rocks. "And my lungs are feeling it," I acknowledged, and struggled to keep up with Chang. He saw my distress and slowed, without saying anything that could embarrass me. I appreciated that. "How long for us to adjust?"
"The doctors aren't sure. Normal adjustment to high altitude is several days to a week. The difference here is the atmospheric pressure is slightly higher than sea level pressure on Earth. Here the mix of oxygen is lower.
The doctors are concerned that we may be slow to adjust because we're taking in actually a greater volume of air with each breath that might fool our bodies into not realizing the oxygen deficiency. We will have to monitor people and ourselves for signs of altitude sickness. We already have people with headaches."
The list of people with headaches might include me. Since our battle with the Theranan Destroyer Squadron, I had not been sleeping well, nor sleeping enough. There had been too much to do and too much to worry about. One thing I was hoping for on Newark was that with nothing much to do but remain concealed and wait for Skippy to fix the ship, we would have plenty of time to catch up on sleep. Except Chang said we'd need to adjust to sleeping in higher gravity. Great. "What else have we learned so far?" I asked.
"We do have news that would be good," Chang said, "except that it is useless to us. The life on Newark would be edible to humans, if there was anything here to eat."
He nudged a low-growing shrub with a boot.
"The sugars and proteins that make up plants on Newark can be digested by humans. Unfortunately, all we've found so far is grass, some shrubs, and a sort of lichen growing on the rocks. No land animal life other than microscopic organisms in the soil. In the stream, there are tiny things like water insects, tiny sort of shrimp, and a sort of fish, nothing larger than a few millimeters. Nothing we could potentially eat. Our science team," he pointed to a group further up the canyon, up to their knees in the frigid water, "is enjoying this immensely. Even the people who are not biologists are pitching in to collect samples."
I could see Dr. Venkman, the science team leader and an astrophysicist, bending down to carefully scoop something out of the water. She looked like she had just found a gold nugget, and she was excitedly gesturing to the others. Dr. Zheng, the biologist, was actually kneeling in the stream, which had to be freezing cold. She was saying something to Venkman with a look of rapturous joy across her face. This was an entirely new biosphere for Zheng to explore, and she was the first human biologist to examine it, and the first human biologist to have access to Theranan technology. She, for one of us, was thrilled to be on Newark.
"It's great they're having fun. Have they done anything useful?"
"Except they did already determine our biology is compatible with the native life." I was intrigued.
"How did they do that so quickly?"
"They used a Theranan scanner that is designed to do just that. Tell the Theranan whether a planet's organisms are compatible with their own. Since human and Theranan biology both use the same basic types of sugars and proteins, it was simple. And the science team has helped us validate that the caverns are suitable for us. You'll see. We've explored two major caverns here."
He pointed to two caves. One had a large, arched opening. The other cave's entrance was narrow and tall. The extra gravity was weighing me down already. It was damp, chilly, with dark gray clouds overhead, and it had just started to rain. This was going to be our home for months. Fantastic. "Let's get inside," I suggested. Skippy made contact, of course, at 0224 hours on our sixth day on Newark. He had told me it would take 5 days for the missile to deliver our end of the micro wormhole, and I had waited anxiously for a signal from him all the previous day. Anything could have gone wrong up there. If Skippy didn't contact us, we would be stranded on Newark and never know what had happened to the Flying Dutchman. After sitting up waiting for a signal on my Z-phone until well after midnight, I finally laid down on my cot and went to sleep. Skippy's muffled voice came out of the Z-phone under the rolled-up jacket I was using as a pillow. "Ugh." I pulled the phone out, glancing at the time code in the upper right corner.
"Hi, Skippy," I whispered.
"Hey, Joe," he shouted. "Skippy," I said in a harsh whisper. "People are trying to sleep here." Everything okay up there? Oh, sure, Joe. Everything is wonderful. I'll tell you all about it. First, I... Great. Everything is wonderful. So this can wait until morning, right?
I'll talk to you then, I said through a jaw-stretching yawn.
What? I want to talk...
Good night, Skippy. This biological trash bag needs sleep.
In the morning, Skippy was initially peeved at me. Then he quickly cheered up. The missile had arrived on time the previous day. Then Skippy had to maneuver it into position, release the micro-wormhole, and test it. The flower, with the two dropships, had arrived safely back at the Dutchman, and Skippy was busy taking the ship apart. He was extra chatty after being out of contact, and he wanted to see everything. After a quick breakfast, I gave him a tour of the caverns. Major Sims was in the back of the main cavern, still getting our small mountain of supplies unpacked.
"Good morning, Skippy," she said. "What do you think of our beautiful new home away from home?"
"Oh, it looks great. You did a great job. Looks very cozy," Skippy said. "Major Tammy, are you sure you want to trust Joe in a cavern you fixed up so nicely? He's not the best house guest. There have been incidents." "Ha," I laughed. "Like what?" "How about the time you thought your neighbor had a solid gold toilet and it turned out you peed in the guy's tuba?" "Skippy," I laughed. "That never happened," I explained to Sims, who didn't look entirely convinced. Skippy snorted. "Oh, sure. If you say so, Joe. That guy's still mad. You need to remember, tequila is not your friend." I sighed. "Okay, maybe it did happen. In my defense, there was a lot of tequila involved. I don't remember that day at all. As far as I know, the whole tuba incident was a story somebody made up to embarrass me. On the other hand, everyone in my hometown knows that story, so maybe there was some truth to it." "There are no tubas down here, Skippy. I think we're safe."
"Hmm," he said.
"Might be best to set up a litter box for you, just in case." Sims had done an outstanding job of getting two caverns ready for human occupation. Cots were set up for sleeping, with tarps separated in groups of cots so people had some privacy. There were tables and folding chairs, although not enough for everyone to sit down and eat all at the same time. Lights were attached to the ceilings. Each of the two caverns would be getting a field kitchen. Meals would be less fancy than what we had become used to aboard the Flying Dutchman, but we would not be surviving entirely on MREs after the first couple days. Conditions were not harsh. I was not concerned about survival or people's health, even if the planet was chilly, damp, and generally unpleasant. I wasn't even that concerned about the inevitable boredom. The science team had plenty to occupy them, studying Newark and going through the mountain of data we had collected on the voyage so far. The special forces would no doubt be using Newark as an opportunity to train in a heavy-gravity, low-oxygen environment and to gain additional experience with powered armor suits. Keeping the pilots busy would be more of a problem. We hadn't been able to bring down any type of flight simulator gear, so they would have to do with flight manuals. Some of the pilots and special forces had already volunteered to collect samples for our biologists. I needed to encourage that spirit of teamwork. After a mostly decent first night of sleep, when I got used to my cot and the heavier gravity, I awoke early. Tiptoeing across the cavern, carrying my boots, I got a cup of coffee and went outside to sit on a rock and put my boots on. It didn't surprise me at all that Sergeant Adams appeared silently behind me.
"Where are you going, sir?"
Taking a sip of coffee, I answered, "Nowhere special, Sergeant. Just up to the rim so I can get a view of our cozy little canyon here. Hoping to see a sunrise." That last seemed unlikely. The sky was mostly clouds, and from the wet rocks outside the cavern entrance, it had rained again overnight. The science team was trying to figure a weather forecast from the satellite data. They weren't confident of understanding Newark's climate that well until we reconnected with Skippy.
"No one goes outside alone, sir. Commander's orders."
I had given such an order through my XO.
"Well, sounds like a wise commander." "Jury's still out on that one, sir," she said, with a grin I could barely see in the dim light. "He's doing okay so far."
"You ready?" She held up one foot for me to see her boots were already on.
"Always."
Because Adams had landed with the first wave on the very first dropship, she knew her way around. The canyon wall was steep, especially near the top. Without Adams, it would have taken me forever to find my way up to the canyon rim.
Someone had scouted a route to the top already. There was a rope to hold on to for the final climb to the top. It was less steep than I expected. There was a glimmer of light on the eastern horizon. The satellite view from my Z-phone screen showed patchy clouds overhead, solid cloud cover with rain to the west, and slightly less clouds to the east. It was possible I could see a sunrise my first morning on Newark. That, I would take as a good sign. "Hey, I began to say.
"Sir?" Adams asked.
"Nothing," I said, embarrassed. I was about to ask Skippy for a weather forecast. It's automatic by this point. She nodded.
"I know what you mean. On the ship, I can't get away from him. Now I miss him already."
"Me too." We sat silently for a while, watching the light grow as the local sun approached the horizon. With the increasing light, I could faintly see figures moving about on the floor of the canyon below us. The Spec Ops team commanders had asked me for permission to run early in the mornings. I ordered them to skip this first morning until we could scout the area on foot in daylight. It didn't surprise me they had gotten up early anyway to exercise in the canyon. Inevitably, some of them were going to climb to the canyon rim, and the silence would be disturbed. Before I missed the opportunity, I cleared my throat.
"Can we talk for a minute?"
She turned to look at me in the pre-dawn darkness, her face illuminated only by the glow of the unseen sun.
"If you're going to tell me you think I'm cute, I already know that. Also, I would punch you,
sir." I said stupidly, not knowing what else to say.
"Other than that, I could use someone to talk to also," she added, saving me further embarrassment.
"Why did you come back out here?" I asked quietly.
"We've already had this conversation, sir. Skippy saved our whole planet, and we made a deal with him."
"No, Adams, I made a deal with Skippy. Not humanity, not America, not you. Me. I needed to go back out with Skippy, and we need enough crew to get his magic radio. That doesn't mean you needed to come along on this fool's errand. You've done enough."
"Marines never quit, sir. And we don't stop until the mission is done. This mission isn't done. Unless I missed a briefing along the way."
She wasn't going to answer my question. Not really. So I tried to change the subject. "Why did you join the Marines?" "The truth is, I joined the Army because I wanted to get out of my hometown, and because my father served. What I figured was, I'm in for a couple years, do my duty, get money for college. When they rotated us back from Nigeria, I was hoping to stay stateside for a while. Then, the Ruhar hit us, screwed up all my plans."
"My mother was a Marine," Adams explained.
"I didn't know that," I said. That fact was probably in her personnel file, which I didn't look at. Had it needed to look at.
"She was a sergeant also. When she finished active duty, she went into the reserves for 8 years. After the Ruhar raid, she volunteered again. When we came home, she was working security in Norfolk. My father got a job in the area. They're doing all right. When I told her I was volunteering to go back out, she didn't try to argue with me. My father did, not my mother. She assumed all along that I was going back out. Back out until the job is finished, you know?"
"Yeah, I know." The problem was, this mission might never be complete, unless it involved Skippy leaving us and the Dutchman stranded in deep space. "Did your parents believe your cover story?"
"No. They didn't say it. I could tell."
"Same here. They knew not to ask. My father," I laughed, "wanted me to write or something."
"What did you tell him?"
"That I'd do my best."
"You can't ask for more than that, sir."
"I'm worried that somehow I've used up all our luck out here. This mission has been nothing but bad luck so far."
"Skippy says there is no such thing as luck," she reminded me.
"As Skippy says a lot of things," I cautioned her. "He doesn't always know what he's talking about."
"I have faith that we'll get out of this somehow. That you will get us out of this somehow, and get us back to Earth."
"Oh, great. No pressure on me, then."
"If you didn't want pressure, sir, you shouldn't be wearing those silver eagles," she said. "Hey, look. Sun's coming up."
And so it was. There were patchy clouds on the eastern horizon, enough that we couldn't see the full disk of the local sun. We could see enough. Skippy also said there are no such things as omens either. I think he's full of shit about that. This, I pointed to the sunrise. I'm taken as a good omen. By the end of our first week on Newark, we had settled into a routine. Each morning I got up early, meaning 5:30, to run with a spec ops team. To avoid playing favorites, I joined a different team each morning. By 2 weeks in, the teams had started to mix. Smythe, Chang, and I wanted the teams to learn from each other and to bond as one team, not by nationality. Waking up at 5:30 was a luxury. The sun didn't rise over the horizon until 0600, and I didn't want people stumbling around in the dark unless we were specifically conducting night training. That morning, I ran with a mixed team of SEALs and French paratroopers. As usual, I was dragging in the rear, although it was encouraging that after a 10-mile run, I finished only 100 yards behind. It rained the whole time. I was eager to get out of my wet clothes and put on something dry, if not completely clean. Laundry facilities on Newark were rudimentary, despite the best efforts of Major Sims. "Ah, man," I said with a shiver. "Now that we stopped running, I'm chilled to the bone. Anybody want a hot chocolate?" As soon as the words were out of my mouth, I regretted them. These were super-fit soldiers and sailors who had just finished a hard training run, not little children playing in the snow. "That sounds great," Lieutenant Williams said to my surprise, and other people nodded general agreement. Since our little talk in my office, I had warmed up to Williams, although Skippy was still suspicious, and he referred to him as Baldy Locks. We got hot chocolate made, from a mix, of course, and not as good as homemade. It was hot, it was chocolatey, and it was better than being outside in the rain. Other people wandered over to join us, including Sergeant Adams. It became like an impromptu party, only it was early in the morning, and we had cocoa instead of alcohol. Williams lifted his mug and asked, "Hey, you think maybe before they decided to sell a hot chocolate mix as quick, did they test market a product called Slow?" I laughed. "For when you're not in a hurry?" "Yeah," Williams said. "Like they give you a cocoa bean and a stalk of sugar cane. You make your own cocoa powder." That drew a laugh from the group. "Do-it-yourself hot cocoa?" I asked. My father used to joke about our neighbors who bought a do-it-yourself kit for a full set of oak furniture. Cheap. "What's that?" Williams asked. "For $10 you get," I said while laughing at my own joke, "an acorn and a saw." That got a big laugh. "Waiting for an acorn to grow into an oak tree would still be faster than some contractors out there," Williams said sourly. "My parents gave a contractor a deposit to remodel their kitchen, back before Ruha raided Earth. So far all he's done is tear out half the cabinets and disappear. That's why I really came out here," he added with a grin. "The contractor is apparently not on Earth, so I figured he must be out here someplace. I'm going to hunt him down and drag him back to my parents' kitchen." "Yeah," I said, "I know what you mean. My uncle hired a contractor to build an apartment above his garage. The guy tore the roof off, covered it with a blue top. Then he had to wait for some supplies. Then he hurt his back, or some crap like that. When it got to be November, the top started leaking. My uncle said screw it, and called my father and me. The three of us worked nights and weekends, including over Thanksgiving. Working in a garage with no roof in late November made me want to punch that contractor if I ever met him. Anyway, it rained all Thanksgiving weekend. We had a roof on by that time, but no heat in there. It reminds me of the weather on this miserable planet." "Hey, Joe," Skippy said from the Z-phone on my belt. "Look on the bright side. With this cold, crappy weather, you don't need to worry about having a beach body this summer." "Yeah," I rolled my eyes. "That's what I was worried about. You know, all that shaving and plucking and waxing," Skippy mused. "Skippy, it's none of your business what the women here..." "Oh, I was talking about you, Joe." "Very funny. Hey, that reminds me. I've been meaning to ask you, Joe. Why do you shave down there in the shape of a lightning bolt? Wouldn't a question mark be more appropriate for you?" "I don't shave anything," I protested as people began laughing. Adams slapped the table and had tears rolling down her cheeks. She was laughing so hard. "Question mark?" Adams gasped. She had to hold the table not to fall off a chair. "Oh," Skippy said innocently. "Shoot. Sorry, Joe, is this one of those privacy things you talked to me about? Don't worry. Your secret is safe with me," Skippy said, in a cavern full of people. "I don't shave down there," I said through gritted teeth. If I could, I would have strangled that beer can right then. "Aha, okay, got it. Right, you don't. I'm serious, Skippy.
I'm getting mixed signals here, Joe. Can we drop the subject?
What subject? See, I can be discreet.
I looked around the compartment at people who were having a great laugh at my expense and trying to avoid my eyes. Why couldn't I have just left that beer can on a dusty shelf?
Chapter 16.
Mornings began with running, then breakfast. After breakfast, I walked around, checking on people, making sure we had no problems with supplies, that anyone injured or sick was being tended to. Generally letting people know that I cared. After lunch, I had free time, which I was using to study how to fly the Flying Dutchman. Skippy called me as I was learning about flight controls. Joe, it's admirable that you are learning to fly. Are you sure you're not overdoing it? You're training with the Special Forces units, you have all the administrative BS to deal with, and you're way behind on your officer training. It surprised me that he didn't make a snarky joke about how I was learning to fly because I had nothing else to do. Can we be serious for a minute, Skippy? This will only take a few minutes. A 100% dead serious human to advanced being conversation. A minute is not the same as a few minutes. Tell you what, Joe, I'll give it a shot, and I'll pay as much attention as I can, depending on how interesting what you have to say is. Fair enough. Here's the truth. I am learning to fly because I want to be able to pilot the Dutchman all by myself. Skippy, I want to make a deal with you, and this is the serious part. We came out here not knowing what will happen when you contact the collective. Before people signed on, I told each of them there is a very good chance we will not be returning, that the ship will not be able to return after you contact the collective and leave us. Okay, I don't like where this is going, Joe. We already have a deal. Your home planet is safe. I shut down the wormhole. Yes, and we are eternally grateful. Doesn't sound like it if you now want to make a new deal with me. His voice wasn't the usual light-hearted Skippy that I knew. My fault. Deal was not the right word. What I am asking for, Skippy, is a favor. Let me explain what I want and you can decide whether to do this favor for me.
You ask a favor from me?
He said that in a hoarse, scratchy voice. For the moment, I will refrain from making the humorous Godfather references that you know I am dying to say, so make it quick. Thank you. What I want, what I would like, is that after you contact the collective, before you leave us, we take the Dutchman back to Earth and drop off the crew. Then, you and I take the ship back out. Since in this scenario you've already located the collective, you only need me to fly the ship for you. We don't need additional crew to help. It would be finishing like we started, Skippy. Just you and me, one last time.
Huh? Interesting.
What's in it for you, Joe? I'm curious.
What's in it for me is I'm in command of this ship. I'm responsible for the lives of my crew. It's my duty to bring them back safely if I can. If you want to be cynical about it, what's in it for me is avoiding a guilty conscience.
Wow. Okay. I will think on that a while. Thanks.
Is this one of those things where you have to think on it, and you already did that between saying and while?
That would be a no, Joe. This isn't simple high-order mathematics. This is a moral question. Also a practical one. I will consider it.
To my surprise, Skippy didn't give me an answer the next day, or the day after that. Either he was still considering it, or his answer was something I didn't want to hear, and he was sparing my feelings while I was on the cold, miserable planet. My thinking was that I'd ask him about it again after we were back aboard the Flying Dutchman. In the meantime, I stuck to my routine. Get up, go run in with the Spec Ops team. That morning, I ran with the Chinese team, and Captain Zhou had planned a very tough 10-kilometer run up and down steep hills. It was a struggle. My lungs were burning, my breathing ragged, and my legs felt like rubber. The Chinese took pity on me and paused at the top of a hill. Captain Zhou knelt on the ground, broke a small branch off a shrub, and examined it closely. After looking at it and sniffing, he touched a finger to the place where he'd broken it off, then tasted a tiny sample of the sap, or whatever it was.
"Should you be doing that?" I asked him. "Is that safe?"
My concern was heightened because the plant life on Newark was edible to humans. Perhaps the poisons could affect humans also.
"Yes, it's safe," he replied. "The science team tested these plants. They're not edible to us. They're also not poisonous.
If we brought goats with us, they could eat these grasses and shrubs. The lichen, also. Goats will eat anything, he said with a grin. I was thinking, he said as he held the piece of shrub up to examine its bark, how useless much of our training on Earth was.
How do you mean? I asked.
Part of our training for Chinese Army Special Forces is to live off the land. We are trained to identify edible and poisonous plants and animals. We are expected to survive on our own for weeks, even months, in different habitats. Jungles, deserts, forests, the Siberian tundra. Drop me almost anywhere in the world and I can find something to eat. I can make tools and clothing. All the things needed for independent survival. Now, here, he gestured to the horizon with a branch, all that training is useless. There is not a single thing to eat on this entire planet, and no animals to use for furs, skins, nothing.
Ha! He laughed. It wasn't all useless, I assured him. You learn to improvise, to think on your own, to keep a positive attitude, and to adapt. We've all had to adapt, and I think we've done well. I wish, I said, massaging my aching right calf muscle, that my body adapted to this extra gravity and low oxygen as well as we have all mentally adapted to our situation.
Perhaps you are right, Colonel, Joe said, flinging the branch down the hill. Let's see how we adapt now to running down this hill and up the next one.
Ah, I groaned. This is going to be fun.
Not.
Part of being the commander was to check on every person on Newark. I tried to talk with each group at least twice a week. That morning, it was the science team's turn, and I wandered over to where Dr. Venkman was doing something at a tablet that held a pile of scientific instruments.
Good morning, Doctor, I said. How's the science going?
Good, good. We are currently struggling with a puzzle. Some aspects of the biology here make no sense.
Like what? Keep in mind I'm not a biologist.
Venkman laughed.
Neither am I. The biology department people treat me as a mascot, or a gopher. I don't mind one bit. This is fascinating. I took a biology course in college because it was required. Now I wish that I'd paid more attention.
We did not have a biology department. Venkman was still thinking in academic terms. I knew what she meant.
My last biology course was as a sophomore, maybe my freshman year of high school. The fact that I hadn't taken a biology course in college because I hadn't yet gone to college wasn't mentioned. She knew it. I knew it.
Here is the problem, in the simple terms that were explained to me. Look at this. Tell me what you see.
She pointed to her iPad, which was hooked up to a fancy Theranos imager microscope thing that we'd brought down from the Dutchman. Under the imager was a stick, a small branch from one type of small shrub that grew everywhere on Newark. Everywhere that wasn't covered by ice or ocean, or rocks. I used my fingers to pinch the image and zoom out, then zoomed in to enhance the image. The imager was impressive. I kept going just to experiment how detailed it could get until I was seeing individual cells, then inside the cells. Venkman shifted her feet beside me. I took that as a cue she was growing impatient with my playing around. Bringing the image back to where I started, I stared at the branch, or twig, or whatever it was. It's a branch from one of the shrubs out there.
Yes, I meant, what do you see here?
She pointed to a small bump, a raised area of bark with a tiny scar of a slightly darker color. This time I put some thought into it.
Looks to me like that is where a leaf broke off.
Close. The biologists tell me there was a flower here, a tiny vestigial flower, a bud that doesn't develop into a full flower because the plant does not any longer put energy into growing flowers.
Huh. Even now that I knew what I was looking at, it didn't mean anything to me. I couldn't tell the scar had been from an undeveloped flower falling off. It could have been a leaf for all I knew. I read somewhere, hopefully that sounded more impressive than the truth that I'd seen it on TV, that some big snakes, like pythons, have tiny rear legs under their scales. Snakes evolved from lizards. They used to have legs before they started slithering on the ground.
Correct, Venkman said with a smile. Along the way, in snakes, The gene that causes legs to develop has become switched off. Here, with these shrubs, we haven't made any progress in analyzing their DNA, of course. What we do know is these plants used to have flowers, but since flowers are no longer useful, the plants have stopped growing them fully.
Okay. What is the part that doesn't make sense? The plants no longer need flowers now, or that they used to need flowers?
Both.
It pissed me off a little that the great Dr. Venkman was toying with me instead of giving me a straight answer. Maybe she saw a flash of irritation on my face because she added, I didn't get it either at first. We are not biologists, that is for certain.
The biology team explained that any plant which used to flower and now does not means that plant used to rely on animals, like insects or birds, for pollination. Typically, an animal goes from a flower on one plant, picks up pollen as it eats the nectar the flower provides, and deposits that pollen on another plant when it visits the flowers there.
Like bees, right? There are no birds or insects on Newark.
Precisely the problem. Plants here would not have evolved flowers unless there used to be animals to use the flowers. The purpose of flowers, their color and scent, is to attract animals. There are no animals, no land animals, and certainly no flying animals today on Newark. Plants, therefore, no longer waste energy growing flowers. It appears they now use the wind to disperse pollen.
Where did all the animals go? Oh, I got it in a flash of insight. Newark must have been warmer in the past.
Much warmer. This area near the equator should have been very warm, even tropical.
So the planet is in an ice age now.
A major, catastrophic ice age. We know through data downloaded from the Kristang satellites that it snows even at the equator here, depending on the season. I mentioned it to Skippy. The science team asked him about it. He replied that is mildly interesting. He may devote some processing resources to the climate question when he is done repairing our starship.
An ice age? How did that happen?
We don't know. That is one of the many mysteries about this world. Colonel, being on Newark isn't something we would have planned. But this is a bonanza for the science team.
Running in the mornings with Spec Ops teams was good for me, both physically and to familiarize myself with the people under my command. It was such a good idea that it gave me another good idea. Good evening, Dr. Zheng, I said, acting as if I had casually dropped by the table she was using as a makeshift laboratory. Plant samples and vials of soil and water covered the table, all of it carefully labeled. I knew because I had helped her gather some of the samples. Your personnel file says you are a triathlete before you signed on with us. She looked up at me in surprise.
Only halves. I competed in 2 or 3 half Ironmans a year. Never had time to train for a full one.
Only a half Ironman. That's what, 70 miles?
70.3.
Of course she knew the distance to the tenth of a mile. She also knew the exact times of her last 5 or so races. That's how serious endurance athletes were. Anyone who competed in multiple half Ironmans every year was, in my view, a serious athlete, considering the training time they put in every week. You have a doctorate in biology. You are also a, I almost said real, a medical doctor. You were a surgeon? You practiced as a surgeon?
Yes, I was a surgeon for 6 years. Then I got into medical research. That's when I went back to university for a second doctorate in biology.
You know that, Colonel.
It's part of the reason I was selected for the science team. As a backup medical doctor, in case the Theranan medical technology fails or is unavailable. Like now.
We are grateful to have you here on Newark with us. So far there had not been a need for a medical doctor on Newark. I wasn't expecting that happy situation to continue for the length of our stay. Extra gravity, low oxygen, damp, cold conditions, living underground, boredom, poor morale, all of those factors could lead to misjudgments and accidents. If, when, that happened, we would need human doctors. You have continued exercising aboard the Dutchman? That wasn't a question. I'd seen her in the gym.
As much as we can, yes. It's not like we can go for a 50-kilometer bike ride or an open-water swim. Why are you asking this, Colonel?
Because, I explained, if our special forces ever need to go into action on Newark, they will need a real doctor with them. They have 2 medics, guys who went through a crash course before we left Earth. There's no substitute for a real doctor. That means a doctor who is capable of going into action with them, not participating in the fighting, I mean traveling with them wherever they go.
While I don't expect our Spec Ops soldiers will need combat here on Newark, I do believe in being prepared. Sergeant Adams, you know Sergeant Adams. She nodded. She and I have been training with Spec Ops teams in the mornings. You would not need any of the hand-to-hand combat or weapons training. You would need to run, march with a pack, learn to climb, and also to lift weights. Would you be willing to do that? I'm not talking anything crazy like getting bounced out of bed at 0300 for a 10-mile run, but you only need to participate in simple endurance training. If a Spec Ops team has to go somewhere, they're likely to be going on foot, and they'll need a qualified doctor with them. The bonus to you, I added, is getting out of these caverns every day. It's not the most pleasant weather out there. It is a change of scenery from this. I pointed at the gray rock ceiling.
What about Dr. Rasa? She asked. Or Tanaka?
She didn't ask about Suarez, who was an experienced doctor and molecular biologist, and was also 58 years old, and not someone I could picture going on a 20-mile hike with special forces. Tanaka said yes when I asked them this morning. Rasa is a swimmer, not a runner. Also, he got an ankle sprain yesterday, twisted it walking in the stream bed. He won't be running for a while.
Me and Tanaka?
And me, and Sergeant Adams, for training with a Spec Ops team. Doctor, I know this planet is a tremendous opportunity for a biologist, maybe a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity. There's an entire biosphere out there to be explored. This training will only take a couple hours each morning, 6 days a week. I promise that when we're out running or on a hike and you see something you want to get a sample of, we will stop.
Can I think about it, Colonel?
Sure. If you're in, we're going out for a run at 0800 tomorrow.
Oh, she said, surprised. I thought you'd be starting earlier.
No, I don't want people running in unfamiliar terrain when it's dark. The last thing we need is sprained knees and broken legs down here. Spec Ops teams will be able to conduct night training once a week to maintain proficiency. You won't have to go with them. Again, I do not expect any military action while we are on Newark. I want to avoid that, except under exceptional circumstances. Think about it, please, and let me know in the morning. Because of the austere conditions on Newark, we made an extra effort to gather as many people as we could in the main cavern for the evening meal. The mood was tense and glum. Everyone, including myself, was afraid Skippy would be ultimately unable to repair the Dutchman and we'd be stuck on an ice planet until our food ran out. To lighten the mood, I tapped a fork on my coffee mug to get people's attention. Knowing Skippy was, of course, listening, I cleared my throat and said, "I have an announcement." "Skippy, hey, when we were in the firefight surrounded by that Theranan destroyer squadron, you told me something that surprised me. You've grown fond of us monkeys." No way could I let an opportunity like this slip by. "How did that happen?" "Oh, man, I should have known you wouldn't let that slide," Skippy responded. "I lowered my expectations, is all. Lowered them until they hit the ground. I dug a hole, and when I hit bedrock, I got a big drill and punched down as far as I could. And when the drill ran out, I jumped up and down on my expectations to squish them some more. And finally, I took a big steaming dump on my expectations and filled in the hole." "Uh-huh. So, long story short, you totally love us," I said. People chuckled. "Ugh, I hate my life," Skippy grumbled. "Skippy loves us. Skippy loves us. Shut up. Damn it. Why didn't I jump us into that star?"
"Well, because then we wouldn't have this quality time together, Skippy."
"Exactly. Plenty of stars out there to jump into." "We love you too, Skippy." People laughed out loud. "Damn it. I long for the good old days when I was buried on Paradise, taking a nice, long, peaceful dirt nap," he grumbled. "Why did those stupid lizards have to dig me out of the ground?" Chapter 17 4 weeks into our idyllic tropical vacation on Newark, I got a call.
"Colonel," came the voice of Sergeant Adams in my Z-phone earpiece, "there's something you need to see over here."
"Trouble?" I brushed off my hands, as I'd been helping dig to enlarge one of the back caverns of the lower cave. The rock here was crumbly. That scared me about the cavern's integrity, but a couple feet down we hit a solid rock like granite. If we could clear out all the crumbly rock, we have a lot more space.
Sims had offered to move some of our stack of supplies out of the main cavern if we could find a safe, dry place.
Not exactly, she replied. Not at the moment.
Where are you? I was intrigued.
The cathedral complex, sir.
She meant a large cavern that, to some people, looked like a cathedral. It had a large entrance flanked by tall, column-like stones. The entrance had once been much smaller until the roof collapsed under the crushing weight of snow and ice eons ago, or so our science team speculated. We had looked into the cathedral complex as a possible habitat, but the entrance chamber afforded us little cover, and large, solid stones blocked the way into caves further under the hills. I'd given permission for people to recon the place, in case we could make something of it. The cathedral was conveniently located less than 2 kilometers up the canyon. Still, it was a long walk in heavy gravity and low oxygen, and it would be getting dark soon. You can't give me a hint, Adams?
You'd really better see this for yourself, sir. It's important.
Adams knew that because of our history, she could push me further than other people could. As a colonel, I could have ordered her to tell me what was going on. I didn't. I trusted her judgment instead. Going to the cathedral, with darkness approaching, meant walking up the canyon floor, sometimes splashing knee-deep through the ice-melt stream that meandered from one side of the canyon to another. That afternoon, for the first time in 3 days, it wasn't raining. It was cloudy, bleak, chilly, with a stiff wind blowing straight into my face down the canyon. Looking in front, then behind me, there wasn't another human in sight. Everyone was safely tucked into our caverns except for the team excavating the cathedral complex. I paused to zip up my jacket against the wind and stared down into the stream. There were tiny animals in the water. I'd seen them in the science team's microscopes. They were hardy creatures, and I felt sorry for them. If the science team was right, and I'd seen their evidence with my own eyes, Newark had once had abundant life. There had at least been flying insects or something similar, whatever had spread pollen from flower to flower. Then the planet had somehow become locked in an ice age. It was now a frozen, chilly, icy, rainy, thoroughly miserable place. But once it had been a decent place for life, at least around the equator. Likely I would never see Newark again after we left, and I couldn't imagine another species was choosing the planet for a colony. A gust of wind shook me out of my daydream. I tried to step on rocks to cross the stream, but the rocks were slippery, and I skidded off into the cold water up to my knees. Crap! Whatever reason Adams wanted me at the cathedral, it had better be damned good. Adams was waiting for me at the entrance with a big flashlight. Even with Skippy controlling the satellite images, we didn't like to use artificial light in the open. It was too risky. Whatever she wanted me to see, it didn't have her scared. The expression on her face was, I thought, excited. And sad. A deep sadness. What's the big secret, Adams? She turned and walked toward the back of the cathedral, toward the large, flat stone we called the altar.
You'll see, sir.
We had to clamber over stones and squeeze around a large boulder that had once been part of the ceiling. I had never been this far back into the cavern before. The science team, with a lot of help from soldiers who were bored and had nothing else to do, had excavated a huge pile of stones that had blocked the way into what we thought might be a much larger chamber. There was not yet any large cavern. There was a path that had been made to get by the big boulder. Then we had to walk steeply up through a long, low-ceiling passage and into a tall, narrow chamber. As I crouched down in the passage, nearly scraping my head on the ceiling, I grumbled, Adams, if this is a surprise party for my birthday or something, there had better be a big goddamn cake. There was no cake. There was a well-lit chamber, square, roughly 10 meters on a side, and it was tall, perhaps 6 meters. It was square. Square, like, almost precisely. In some areas there were indentations in the walls that had once been filled with some sort of brick and plaster. The plaster had weakened over time, and some bricks had tumbled onto the floor. On the floor there was a stacked pile of bricks and another stack of carved stones. Carved. Artificial. None of what I saw could have been natural. I gasped and looked up at Adams. She nodded.
I know, sir. I couldn't believe it either when I saw it. Dr. Graziano found it this morning.
And you waited until now to tell me?
Graziano explained.
We wanted to be certain that these stones don't merely give the appearance of having been carved. These stones are old, Colonel, old. They would have flaked off and looked like much of nothing if this chamber hadn't kept them dry all this time.
All what time? How long ago? If there were other sentient beings on Newark, I wanted to know immediately.
He shrugged.
I don't know. Not yet. I'll need Mr. Skippy to assist with the analysis. Very old. Hundreds of thousands of years at the very least. Probably more.
He ran a hand lightly along one carved edge.
Whoever made this, they are long gone from here.
Huh, I said, glancing around the rock chamber. The years had eroded it somewhat. Still, I could see the stone walls had been shaped, smoothed, by someone's hand long ago.
So, what, you think some aliens took shelter here? They got stuck on Newark and created this place to take shelter while they waited for rescue?
Enlarging a chamber is something that I could see a stranded starship crew doing, especially if they didn't have power cells for heat like we did. Why they would carve stones into blocks made little sense. Why would they need to build a wall?
Were they Cristang?
Graziano glanced at Adams, and she gave a little shrug.
He doesn't know, she said to the scientist. I thought he should see for himself.
We found it only a few hours ago, Graziano explained to me.
Come this way, please, Colonel Bishop.
He pointed to an opening in the far wall that was so low he needed to get on hands and knees and crawl. The opening had at one time been blocked up by stones, which Graziano and his team had carefully removed. I followed on hands and knees, with Adams behind me. Graziano and Adams had lights. I should have brought one along. That was stupid of me. It was growing dark outside anyway. The passageway we had to crawl through was only 20 feet long. It soon opened up into another chamber, this one far larger. This chamber had also been worked on by sentient beings. The walls were smooth and straight. That wasn't all. There were bones. Bones and tools. Bronze tools. Axes. Shovels. Spears. Swords. Arrowheads. The tools were mostly upright in ceramic containers, with a few scattered on the floor where their ceramic containers had broken. None of the bones were scattered. They were all carefully laid on carved stone slabs. The bodies may have been dressed in fine clothing or wrapped in ceremonial cloth, but now they were only bones. Some had bronze shields laid atop them, some without. I knelt down to examine one set of bones. Bipedal, like us. Two arms, two legs, a head with holes for two eyes, and an opening for a nose that was more horizontal than humans. The leg bones were heavy, and they were short, shorter than the average human. Shorter than humans used to be in ages past? I didn't know. The carvings on the slabs were eroded, their edges rounded. I reached out to touch a carving when Graziano coughed. Sorry, I said guiltily, looking at the gloves he was wearing. I wanted to see if these carvings show what they looked like.
They do.
He pointed at one slab where Drs. Venkman and Friedlander were painstakingly clearing off accumulated dust with soft brushes. Graziano led me over to a shield which had been removed from the body it covered. The shield had been partly cleared of corrosion, exposing an area which depicted a figure in highly realistic detail. The figure stood on two legs. It carried a sword in one hand and some type of plant or branches in the other. It was overall more squat and bulky than a modern human, and what I thought at first was a helmet was, after close inspection, a bony ridge on top of its head. I glanced between the bones on the stone slab to the depiction on the shield. The bones also had a bony ridge.
They were shorter than us, I remarked without thinking.
The higher gravity, Graziano noted. Thicker bones also.
This was not a starship crew, I said almost to myself, considering the bronze tools.
Surely any species advanced enough to make starships would have tools of steel rather than bronze, or they would have tools constructed of composites or exotic materials, not bronze.
These almost I said creatures. These were not mere creatures. They created tools be working metal. These were people.
These people were natives here. How is that possible on this frozen planet?
Yes, Venkman said, standing up to brush the dust off her pants. These were natives.
Remember what I showed you about the plants that used to have flowers? Newark used to be warmer, significantly warmer. These people, as you say, are more evidence to support that conclusion.
And then what? I asked, peering intently at the figure on the bronze shield. The planet went into an ice age and they all died? Everything? Not only them. All planets and animals on land went extinct?
We don't understand how. Friedlander joined the conversation. He was a rocket scientist on loan to UNEF from NASA. We may never know the mechanism. Not unless we stay here and study this planet much longer than we plan to.
They all died? I couldn't process that. An entire species, an entire civilization gone, completely wiped out. Because of an ice age?
Yes, Venkman replied. This is not unprecedented. There is genetic evidence that the total human population shrank to as few as 5 or 10,000 people around 70,000 years ago.
The Toba catastrophe, Graziano started to say.
That is only one theory, Friedlander interjected, and there is contradictory evidence.
Toba? I asked, wondering if T-O-B-A was an acronym for something.
Toba was a supervolcano in Indonesia. It erupted around 70,000 years ago, Venkman explained, and left a thick layer of ash around the planet. There is a theory that the Toba event caused a global winter, and that event roughly coincides with a bottleneck in human genetic diversity. The point, Colonel, is that we came close to humanity going extinct, perhaps several times. With the severe changes to temperatures on Newark, it is not surprising that a relatively advanced civilization would not have been able to adapt quickly enough to survive. Imagine if ice had advanced down from the poles to the equator on Earth during the time of ancient Egypt or Sumeria. Would those people have been able to survive?
She shook her head. They all died, I said quietly, and no one responded. They all knew I wasn't asking a question. We are near the equator here. They came here as the temperature dropped. To what? Try to survive in caves? Why wouldn't they have chosen the caverns we are living in now? The cathedral is too open, I pointed out. That's why we weren't living in it. Graziano spoke first.
We think, Colonel, that what we call the cathedral used to extend forward much further. We believe the canyon outside did not exist back then. It was probably an ordinary stream on the surface in that time. Over the years, glaciers advanced, retreated again, over and over, and the ice and seasonal melt flooding carved the canyon. The roof of the cathedral was underground back then, and with hot springs around, these caverns would have been one of the last places the natives, he pointed to the dry bones, could have survived the deep freeze. They held out here, the last of their kind, until the food ran out or diseases took them. With the population clustered tightly together here, pathogens could have spread widely, especially with these people stressed from severe cold and poor nutrition.
The weight of the glacier collapsed the roof of the cavern? I didn't like hearing that. If one roof could collapse, then the roofs of our two caverns could be unstable, weakened by past glaciers.
That is possible, yes. It is more likely that seasonal flooding of the stream slowly wore away material above the cavern, exposing the stones that formed the roof. It would have been weakened. Water gets in, freezes, causes cracks. The cracks widen, more water seeps in. It is a slow process. Over the course of 100,000 years, perhaps 1,000,000 years, water is unstoppable.
Millions? I asked, surprised.
As of now, we don't know, Graziano admitted. This chamber was sealed until we broke in. The stones were set very closely together, using almost no mortar to fill the gaps. Moisture and oxygen were kept out, and this chamber is above the cathedral. It is protected from flooding. We see marks of flooding on the walls of the cathedral chamber. The flood marks reach only one-third of the way up that low-ceilinged passageway you climbed. I looked around the chamber. They didn't live in here. This was a tomb. They left the bodies and sealed it behind them.
We think so, yes, Venkman said. It may have been one of the last things they did. Perhaps the very last thing. I would not be surprised to find more bones and more tools beneath the floor of the cathedral. The items here and in the chamber before this one were preserved because moisture and oxygen were kept out after the chambers were sealed.
I can't imagine this, I said with complete candor. A civilization,
an entire species, moving steadily toward the equator as the cold crept down from the poles until they reached the furthest point they could go, and it too began to freeze.
No one can, Friedlander said quietly.
News of the discoveries at the cathedral complex spread like wildfire among our small population, and with news inevitably came rumors. By the following morning, so many people wanted to visit the cathedral complex that I knew I had to do something about it. Graziano, who had slept at the cathedral overnight, had come back to the main cavern for more supplies that morning, so I found him talking with Major Sims. Dr. Graziano, I said, could you put together a briefing of what we think we know at the moment? There are a lot of rumors flying around. There's no reason for disinformation. Sims snorted when I said that. I knew what she was thinking. Sorry, Major, I offered. There was a time when disinformation was necessary on Paradise. I couldn't tell the truth about Skippy without revealing it to the people who were staying behind, and we couldn't risk them telling the Ruha or Kristang or whoever is in control of Paradise at the time. Besides, I gave a grin that I hoped would lighten the mood. That was a damned inspiring speech I made, right? Sims snorted. It wasn't your speech, sir. Frankly, given your... what little I know of your reputation, she glanced at me to gauge my reaction, I was afraid the Special Forces mission you claimed to be running would be some slapdash operation thrown together at the last minute. Like going after an invading force with an ice cream truck? Yes, sir. I didn't know much about you before you fell out of the sky onto my base in a stolen Ruha spaceship. All I knew was you did some rash thing on Earth and got lucky, then you got promoted as a publicity stunt for the Ruha. Sorry, sir, that's what most people were thinking at the time. No apology needed, Major. I knew it was a publicity stunt. I was afraid UNEF would have me going around giving speeches to sell war bonds or something before they assigned me to plant potatoes. Sims nodded. That dodo you flew in, that was more convincing than any speech. Being able to steal and fly an alien aircraft was impressive. Oh, and when you came out of the dodo, stunned those Ruha, and they weren't able to shoot back? I saw that happen. One of those Ruha was totally shocked that his rifle didn't work. That and the message from UNEF HQ that I now know Skippy faked, and her mouth turned down at the thought of being manipulated. Sorry about that. It was necessary. If it wasn't my speech, what convinced you to come with us? Those faked orders from UNEF HQ, and you caught us at the right moment. You said you were going to hit the Kristang, not the Ruha. We'd all heard rumors about what was going on back on Earth. I'd seen fortune cookies myself. We got them regularly enough when we opened boxes at the warehouse. You were the first UNEF soldier who told us what we all wanted to hear, that we were taking action against the Kristang. We also, especially us in the Supply Corps, figured we didn't have much to lose. How's that? I couldn't understand what she meant by that last remark. We knew better than anyone else how thin our food stocks were getting back then, Sims explained. You sent Chang and Adams to the warehouse to check on supplies, and they came back to the dodo saying supplies were adequate, right? That was a while ago. I had to pause to think back that far. Sure. What they didn't know is the warehouse was a lot more empty than it looked. My aide and I would go into the warehouse late at night with a wheelbarrow of rocks, use the rocks to fill food boxes that we pushed to the back of the shelves. Then we'd fudge the inventory records, so even my people didn't know how thin our supplies were. I gave orders that we weren't to issue the last two boxes of anything without my direct approval, so people didn't unknowingly issue a box of rocks to the field. When we loaded up the dodo, I made sure we got only real food containers, not rocks. That surprised me. Major, I knew our food stocks were running low. I had no idea. HQ knew, she said. They were closing regional logistics centers, supposedly to consolidate operations as we cleared hamsters by sector. The real reason is that HQ didn't want people to see empty warehouses. You take what little supplies are left, concentrate the supplies in a few logistics bases, and when people see those bases have plenty of supplies, they think we're good. They didn't see the overall situation. My base was scheduled to shut down in 2 weeks before the Ruha took the planet back. I was sweating that by the end of 2 weeks I figured all we'd have left is boxes of rocks. My CO knew about me faking inventory records. I got the idea from an intel officer with UNEF HQ. Intel, I said sourly. Yeah, I know the type.
As the words came out of my mouth, I realized that, however I'd felt screwed by my experience with intel operations, I'd done worse. Much worse. I had deceived people, concealed the truth, revealed only those parts of the truth I felt was convenient at the time. All for a good cause, of course. If I hadn't deceived people, we would never have gotten enough volunteers.